May the words of my mouth and the meditation of each heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. As a high schooler, I had pretty good friends. Some of you might call them boring friends. They didn't party, they got good grades, they were involved in lots of extracurricular activities. Many of them were very engaged and involved in their churches. And so it seemed extraordinarily ridiculous to me when a Friday night came along and my mom didn't want me to go out with my friends. In my estimation, at 16, I shouldn't have even had to ask my parents if I could do stuff with my friends, but since we had just had dinner together, it seemed reasonable that I mention that I was planning to go sledding with my friends that night, like actual sledding on saucers down a hill. This was not a ruse for something else more illicit. We were just gonna go sledding because it was the middle of the winter. My mom thought that this was a terrible idea, and she made sure that I knew it. I suppose that her reasoning was sound enough. It was going to be dark. It was a steep hill. Rumor was that someone had iced it down. But as a junior in high school, I was pretty sure that I knew better than my mom, and I knew that we would be just fine. Mind you, this was less than a month after I'd gone ice skating with the same group of friends, and I ended up with stitches for the first time in my chin, but whatever. So friends had been going there all winter, and they, too, were just fine, so I had reasoned that this was all going to be fine and well and good. And so when my friend Amy showed up in her Dodge Neon, I piled into it without giving it a whole lot more thought. Well, as my mom had predicted, the hill was steep and icy and dark. And on our first run down, we kind of spun out at the bottom of the hill. Fun, right? And so I was straddling my friend Lindsay. She was in the first seat. I was in the second seat. We were now facing up toward the top of the hill when we saw the next pair of sledders coming down straight toward us, stopped at the bottom of the hill by my ankle. "Oh, just walk it off," my friends encouraged. "Well, let us do one more run, and if it still hurts, then we can go home." Well, I knew immediately that I was not going to be walking it off and that I needed to go home right then and there. This particular walk of shame involved my friend Amy, who was a good foot taller than me, giving me a piggyback ride across my parents' driveway and into my parents' house, from whence we departed to the emergency room. Sometimes, despite all the warnings, we do something we really shouldn't do. When the Israelites beg for a king, Samuel knows that it's a bad idea. His reasoning is sound enough, but the people aren't convinced. After all, everyone else has a king, and they're just fine. Why can't we have a king, too? A reading from 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you're following along in your pew Bible, I'm beginning in verse 4. "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'You are old and your sons do not follow in your ways. Appoint for us then a king to govern us like the other nations.' When the people of Israel were still on the other side of the Jordan, Moses had given them permission to ask for a king. In Deuteronomy, Moses instructs the people, 'When you have come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that surround me, you may indeed set over you a king for whom the Lord your God will choose.'" So if the people have already received permission from Moses to ask for a king, why does Samuel seem so upset? Why does he push back? But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us." Now, Samuel knew a little something about the motivation of the Israelites. He knew that it was a little bit different than what Moses had envisioned when he planted these seeds for a monarchy. Moses was imagining a time of peace, a time when the people had come into the land and had taken possession of it. In times of peace, it's a whole lot easier to place some limitations on the power of the monarchy. Moses foresaw a king who would operate under the laws of Deuteronomy, kings who were prohibited from acquiring horses, amassing wealth, and selling people into slavery. Moses was living in a time when God's law reigned. The king wasn't glorified as a military leader, but as a just and equitable leader of the people. Samuel recognizes what perhaps God's people can't see as clearly. They're in a different time and a different place than they were with Moses. Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Just as they have done to me from the day I brought them up out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now then, listen to their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. Be careful what you pray for." When Samuel prays to God, the response that Samuel gets isn't exactly what he hopes for. It's not even what he assumes it will be. "Go ahead and do what Israel is asking," God tells Samuel. It's nothing personal against you. It's about me. I am the one they're rejecting. So let them have their way. Let them have their way, but be sure to warn them to be careful what they ask for. They may, after all, just get it. So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots, and he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and will give them to his courtiers. He will take 1/10 of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers. He will take your male and your female slaves and the best of your cattle and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take 1/10 of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day, you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you that day." Samuel lays it on pretty thick, doesn't he? That is a graphic picture that Samuel has painted. He is doing his darndest to warn his people, to warn God's people of the dangers of a king. A king takes your children, your crops, your livestock, your servants, your own agency, anything that you have of value, a king will take, Samuel warns. The occupation begins with the king taking what he needs to create military infrastructure. And then he starts to commandeer people. Sons become soldiers. Daughters prepare provisions. The best of everything that you have, your grain, your wine, your olive oil, all of that is taken, and it goes to the king and his court. The labor of human beings and of livestock, that's taken too, to do the king's work. Samuel says the king is going to pray on your fears, vague as they may be, fears of a foreign enemy. That's how this king is going to convince you to wage war, even in a time of peace. He'll confiscate your labor and your taxes, and what starts out as a drive to create military infrastructure eventually will lead to the accumulation of these goods for the king himself, for his elite, for the ruling class. And then the whole economy gets topsy-turvy because the elite are gaining wealth over the threat of war, and the common people are ending up as slaves. But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, we are determined to have a king over us so that we may also be like the other nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. Everyone else has a king. Why can't we have one? The Israelites want a king like all the other nations, and now their true colors are showing. They want a king because they want someone who will fight their battles for them. Why, in a time of peace, would the people want a king who leads them into war? I don't know that we can answer that with certainty. Maybe they're insecure. Fear of the unknown digs deep roots, doesn't it? So perhaps there's this shallowly buried fear that the foreigners with whom they've been living peacefully, that they'll again resort to violence, and maybe those roots start to gain some momentum and they break up through that tender topsoil of security to get to the light of day, and there those fears start to grow and quickly. Maybe they're seeking a sense of national pride. A strong military can have that effect. Chris Hedges has said, "War is a force that gives meaning, and without it, the people don't know how to define themselves among the nations." And so we can imagine that perhaps the Israelites fear that their security was at risk. Maybe they sense that violence is one way that they could make meaning of their lives. Whatever it is, the Israelites are willing to sell out their future to a king who they are convinced will offer them protection and military glory. We skip ahead to Samuel chapter 11, verse 14. Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and there renew the kingship." And so all the people went, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they sacrificed offerings of well-being before the Lord, and there Saul, the king, and all the Israelites rejoiced greatly. His sons may not have understood it or embraced it, but Samuel knew that there was a different way. He knew the laws the Israelites lived under in the time of Moses. Deuteronomy holds out this possibility for a different kind of world. As a judge, it was Samuel's job to help God's people live into that kind of world, a world that was just, a world that was equitable, a world like God imagined, a world in which a king's power is kept in check, and a world in which the person responsible for protecting all the others isn't going to start to acquire a bunch of silver and gold in great quantity, a world in which the people couldn't again become merely a source of labor for the enrichment of the few elites. But sometimes, as ordinary people, we can't hear that wisdom. We can't see that vision. We too can get caught up in the vague fear of an unknown enemy. We can start to derive too much meaning from violence and war. We can start to make choices that lead to our own suffering and cause suffering for others. What makes God so extraordinary is that God always, always, always sees and works for a just world, a world where fear doesn't exist, a world where peace is the only thing that makes sense, a world where power is used for good and not for personal gain, a world where resources are shared freely so that the needs of all are met differently, perhaps, but deliberately. More than that, our God is extraordinary because our God holds on. God doesn't give up on us individually or collectively. When we will our way into things that really aren't all that good for us. Who do you think drove me to the ER that night after I'd busted my ankle? Of course, it was my mom. The same mom who didn't think that it was such a good idea that I went sledding in the first place. Whatever, I couldn't tell this story last week because my mom was here. And so let's imagine together the good and beautiful possibilities God has for us in our corner of the world. Let's imagine together how we might release some of our fears by getting to know more of our neighbors. Let's imagine together how we might keep our own privilege and power in check and work to amplify the voices and experiences of those whose stories haven't been heard. Let's imagine together choosing words that reject stereotypes and stigmas, because our words create worlds. Let's imagine together a life where we can discern the difference between equality and equity. Let's imagine together how we, ordinary people, can co-create with God an extraordinary sense of dignity and worth of belonging for all God's people. Samuel's God is our God. And our God, who gives us this bold imagination, is not like the others.